God's faithfulness as seen in our universe by Robert C. Newman. A brief abstract to this talk. A tour of some of the major ways in which our Earth is especially favorable to the existence and continuation of life as seen in our galaxy, our sun, our solar system, our moon, and a number of features of the Earth itself. The Bible tells us that God is faithful. He keeps his promises. He shows us mercy. One of the striking pictures of this is in the book called Lamentations in the Bible, where the prophet Jeremiah says in chapter 3, verses 19 through 23, after the destruction of Jerusalem, "I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I well remember them, and my soul was downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness." One of the most impressive ways in which God shows us his faithfulness and his mercy is in the way he has made our universe so that we can survive in it and enjoy it. We want here to look at some of the features of this universe that God has made for us. We start out by suggesting that we are in the right kind of galaxy. About 20% of the galaxies out there, by current counts, are what we call elliptical galaxies. They basically are a large ball of largely stars, very little dust. Yeah, there's probably some gas around. And some of these are basketball-shaped. Some of these are kind of football-shaped. Some of these are even more platter-shaped, if you like. Here's a picture of a number of galaxies out there taken with the Hubble telescope, and the bright ones here in this picture are all ellipticals, I believe. These galaxies form all their stars in a very short time. That's a characteristic of elliptical galaxies. As a result, the stars, having been formed very early on, have too few heavy elements in them to be able to support life. So we don't live in an elliptical galaxy. 77% of the galaxies are what we call spiral galaxies. They're like the ones we live in. They tend to be flattish and have large amounts of gas and dust in them, varying amounts of gas and dust in them, but large compared with the ellipticals. These galaxies form stars over much of their history, so some of the stars have the heavy elements needed for life. We're made out of heavy elements in astrophysical terminology. Chemists by heavy elements mean probably stuff heavier than iron or so, but astrophysicists mean stuff heavier than perhaps beryllium, lithium, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, and so such. About 2% of the galaxies are irregulars, like this one in Ursa Major. These kind of galaxies have dangerous levels of radiation, which would destroy life within them, but we don't live in one of these. We live in the right sort of galaxy. We also live at the right location in our galaxy. Our galaxy looks something like this picture here at right. We live about two-thirds of the way out from the center. Closer in, there's too much radiation. And closer in, there are lots of stars around and a danger of gravitational disruption of the planetary orbits. Further out, there are not enough heavy elements. And so, material out of which planets and humans are made out of, there would not be enough of. We live in the right place in our galaxy. We have the right kind of star. There's a great variety of stars in our universe. They're here diagrammed for us in this chart called the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, or HR diagram, with the cool stars shown in red on the right side of this picture and the hot stars shown in blue on the left side of the picture. The big stars and the bright stars at the top and the small stars and the dim stars at the bottom. And this kind of an S-shaped thing that runs up the middle is what we call Well, evaporated from my mind right there. But the standard stars that are burning their hydrogen to helium. There's a great variety of stars in our universe. There are large stars and small stars. There are hot stars and cool stars. There are fast-burning stars and slow-burning stars. Our star, the Sun, as shown by the circle there, is an average middle-aged star. Now, a larger star would burn too fast and too erratically, even as close as those shown by the white circle there. A smaller star would burn slowly and evenly, but our planet would need to be much closer to the star because the brightness of the star would be considerably less, and being closer to the star would mean there'd be a large tidal effect on the rotation of our sun, of our Earth, and that large tidal effect would lengthen the days too much. Once you get very long days, even a few times the length of our days, then it gets very cold at night and very hot in the daytime, and that swing can't be too wide, or it will destroy life. Also, under right kind of star, we have to have the right number of suns in our system also, in our planetary system, namely one. Now, obviously, without a sun, our planet or any other planets would freeze. There may be such planets floating around out there. There almost certainly are some such planets that have been thrown out of a planetary system by gravitational interactions. And without a sun, a planet would freeze. With more than one sun, and there may be some star planets of this sort, the orbits of the planets would be unstable. That is, they would not be virtually identical orbit every time around. And this would produce large temperature variations and might even throw planets out of the system. So we're around the right sort of star. We're also in the right location around that star. Astronomers define a term they call the life zone around a star as the region within which the temperature on the planet's surface would be between the freezing and boiling point of water. In this diagram at right, the life zone there is shown as the space there between the bluish area outside and the yellowish area inside, sort of the orange region between two spheres. For our solar system, however, the life zone is actually much narrower than shown here. This was an early estimate of it, and the estimates now are considerably narrower than this. The next planet closer than us to our sun, Venus, lies outside the life zone. With its thick atmosphere, the temperature at Venus's surface is about 900 degrees Fahrenheit, about 500 Celsius. Very, very hot. No life could handle that of any sort that we know of that would involve the complex molecules that we're thinking about. The next planet further from the sun than ours, Mars, also lies outside the life zone, though there's a possibility still that there might be some life surviving down underneath the surface in some kind of very extreme conditions, such as would be worse than what we find in Antarctica on Earth. With a very thin atmosphere, the temperature on Mars barely reaches freezing at the equator at midsummer. Our Earth has just the right temperatures for life. Another item, which our Earth is just right, if you like, is protection from collisions. The neighborhood of a star can be a dangerous place for planets, or at least for life on them. There are comets, and asteroids, and other debris in orbit around the star, or sometimes just passing through in orbit around the galaxy. And these things can strike the planet with violent collisions. We have substantial evidence for many such collisions early in the history of the solar system. Look at the moon's surface, all those craters. The moon, with virtually no atmosphere, has preserved many of these collisions from early in its history. Some of these collision scars, or craters, are over 100 miles in diameter. some of them may even be 400 or 500 miles in diameter. A very large thing up there near the top of this picture. One of the Marite regions looks like it might be a remains of a huge crater. Surface of Mars. Mars has a much thicker atmosphere than the Moon, so most of its craters have eroded away. This crater Ute, however, shown in the upper left in this picture, is over 10 miles across. You can even see the splash from the debris thrown out when it hit us all around it. May suggest that when this hit occurred, that it melted a good deal of frozen water in the layers of the surface, and these came out as a flow of some sort when the stuff splashed. Craters on Earth. Probably the most famous meteor crater on Earth, at least for those of us in the U.S., is this one in Arizona, usually called just Meteor Crater, or more technically, Barringer Crater. It's nearly a mile across and 570 feet from rim to the bottom. It is thought to have formed some 25,000 years ago. In spite of the fact that craters erode rapidly on Earth, some 120 are presently known. This one, Manicouagan Crater in Quebec, is one of the largest still preserved, about 60 miles across. It's believed that a meteor some 10 miles in diameter so disrupted the Earth's climate that all the dinosaurs were killed off. The strike of the meteor, besides producing a huge shockwave and earthquake, if you like, produced a huge firestorm, followed by a multi-year winter and years of drought. And these combined cleaned out the dinosaurs and knocked down an enormous number of other species. Protection from collisions. Recent computer simulations suggest that having a large planet like Jupiter in our solar system has protected Earth and the other planets inside Jupiter, Mars, Venus, Mercury, from many more such catastrophes. Apparently, we live in a solar system designed to protect the Earth. With the right moon, too, in regard to climate protection, for one thing, the Earth's moon is unusually large, one of the largest moons in our solar system. Here we see it compared with the Earth. It is by far the largest of the moons in comparison to its planet size. This turns out to be quite important for life on Earth. Recent computer simulations have shown that the presence of our moon acts as a stabilizer on the Earth's rotational axis, controlling and stabilizing how much it tilts. Mars' axis, by contrast, since Mars has no large moons, two little dinky ones, Deimos and Phobos, tends to flop back and forth over long periods, producing drastic changes in climate. We now have evidence that Mars' climate was once more pleasant than it is now. It appears that Mars once had flowing waters, a thicker atmosphere, and even seas. Whether this is all to be restricted to the very early period of Mars history, or whether this is switched on and off some in its past, has still been debated in recent years. Our moon acts as a protection for Earth's climate. Coming to our own planet itself, we live on the right kind of planet, huh? Our planet itself is just right in many ways, in regard to its size, its atmosphere, its water, its rotation speed, its axial tilt, its orbital shape, and the thickness of its crust. Let's have a quick look at each of these. Earth size. The mass of the Earth is just right. If it were much less Earth there, much less massive, the Earth would not have enough atmosphere to support life, as its gravity could not keep enough atmosphere on the planet to support life. If the mass of the Earth were much more than it is, we'd have a much thicker atmosphere, and Earth's temperature would be too high for life. We'd have a runaway greenhouse effect. Not only is the Earth's atmosphere just right to support life, Earth's atmosphere is also helpful in stopping harmful radiation and in stopping small meteors from reaching the surface. On the moon, with virtually no atmosphere, the meteors, even dust-sized meteors, can come screaming down at many times the speed of a rifle bullet and hit the surface directly. That does not happen on Earth, except with very big meteors that the atmosphere will not slow. Earth's atmosphere is just right in regard to the amount of oxygen. We had much less oxygen, animals would be in trouble surviving on Earth. We had much more oxygen, plants would be in trouble because the increase in oxygen in the atmosphere drives up the chance of spontaneous combustion of plants, given specific atmospheric water vapor level, and plants would be in trouble. The suggestion is that at our particular percentage of oxygen at 21%, that if you raise that oxygen level 1%, the chance of spontaneous forest fires jumps by nearly 80%. Now the carbon dioxide is just right. With much less carbon dioxide, plants would be in trouble. Plants need carbon dioxide to run their photosynthetic cycle. They take in oxygen and water and use sunlight to convert that to carbohydrates, sugar, and then give off oxygen as a waste product, if you like. So if there were less carbon dioxide, they wouldn't have that to operate on. They would be in trouble. If we had much more carbon dioxide, we would have an increased greenhouse effect, maybe even a runaway greenhouse effect. And this is one of the concerns of the whole global warming controversy currently going on. Amount of water vapor, similar situation. Less water vapor, then we would have too little rain. Very serious problems for plants and for animals, for that matter. If we had much more water vapor in our atmosphere, that would again run the greenhouse effect up and run the temperature up and all of that. So the Earth's atmosphere is kind of just right. Earth's water. Earth has an enormous amount of water compared to Mars and Venus. water situation for perhaps a couple of the moons out in Jupiter and Saturn may be similar, but nothing here in close, nothing here in near the life zone. Earth has an enormous amount of water compared to Mars and Venus, and this water isn't uniformly distributed throughout the body of the planet. Earth's water is all concentrated at the surface of the planet. As you go down, there is not much water, and eventually temperature get up high enough, it wouldn't be liquid. And as, of course, you go up in the atmosphere, the water goes very quickly as well, get into the stratosphere, there's very little water. The Earth is covered by enough water that if the Earth were perfectly smooth, there would be about 2-mile ocean everywhere on Earth. As it is, the Earth is about 1/3 above sea level, and the other 2/3 is covered by about 3 miles of ocean. Earth's water is right where it is needed for life and quite adequate. Earth's rotation speed. If Earth's rotation speed were much higher than it is, that would increase the velocity of the winds on the surface of the Earth. We have too much wind. An example here would be Jupiter, which has winds running at hundreds of miles an hour regularly. If the Earth's rotation speed were much lower, then the days would be too long, and the result of that would be it would get too hot in daytime and too cold during the nighttime, what we call too much diurnal temperature variation. And a comparison there would be Mercury, where the temperature is over 100 degrees below zero Fahrenheit on the night side and gets up around 500 degrees on the day side. The reason that it gets so high as that is that it's a lot closer to the sun than we are, but that huge temperature swing is a diurnal variation. Earth's axial tilt. The picture right is Uranus. It's a false color photo where temperature differences have been exaggerated and shown in color. And the reason to do this is to show you the strange angle of the axis on which the planet Uranus rotates around itself. Uranus's axial tilt is so large that sometimes its north or south pole is pointing virtually directly towards the sun, and sometimes directly away, sometimes at right angles, so large that parts of the planet have days and nights that last for many Earth years. If Earth had that kind of axial tilt, you'd have a situation in which it would be night for many months over large parts of the Earth rather than just over the very small parts around the poles as we have now, with much more axial tilt like that, you get too much temperature variation. And with virtually no axial tilt, you don't get that kind of temperature variation, but you don't get a seasonal variation either. The tilt of our axes allow us to have seasons, which are pretty important in temperate zones, not that significant in the tropical zones, although even here it may have an effect on the idea of having a rainy or a dry season. Earth's orbital shape. Earth has a very nearly circular orbit as it moves around the Sun. This is true of most of our planets, with the exception of Mars and especially of Pluto. If our orbit was more elongated, there would be too much temperature variation throughout the year as the planet went around this orbit. And again, you get too big a temperature swing moving through your orbit, you would kill off life in either too hot or too cold or too much change. Earth's crust. The Earth's crust is just the right thickness. If it were much thinner, there'd be too many earthquakes and too much volcanism for life to function well. If it were thicker, the crust would eat up too much of the atmospheric oxygen. Make it very hard for life to function there as well. The strange thing is that the amount of crust that Earth has seems to be due to a great fluke. We now have evidence that the Earth was struck early in its history by a Mars-sized planet, and that this collision stripped off most of the Earth's crust, making it into our moon, so that this very fluky event early in Earth's history produced our very big moon and also produced our very thin crust compared with, say, Mercury or Mars. The upshot is that we have this moon protecting the axial tilt of the Earth, and we have this thin crust that's not too thin, so that we've got too much volcanism and such, but it's thin enough for plate tectonics to occur, thin enough for the Earth to be able to recycle some of its materials, and particularly its carbon dioxide, and keep that the right levels as well. What do we say in conclusion to all of this? Well, taken singly, each of these items may look like an accident, but in combination, they point to a design and a purpose. We suggest that there are manifestations of God's mercy to us, which He does not owe us, that God has given us a marvelous place to live on that is especially tuned to be just the right sort of place. In fact, God has revealed that He will withdraw some of these things at the end of the age. Not so many that everybody will die, but enough that many will die and that many will be scared, and that life will become very, very dangerous. We're told in Matthew 24:9 that the sun will be darkened. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and heavenly bodies will be shaken. How will that happen? We don't know. The sun could be darkened by something happening to the sun, or by some kind of a dark gas cloud passing through our solar system from out beyond. We certainly have some dark gas clouds in our galaxy. Or the sun could be darkened by something happening to the Earth's atmosphere. Been considerable discussion in recent years over the matter of whether a nuclear interchange of a substantial number of weapons might produce what's called nuclear winter by causing a huge amount of fires that carry a great deal of ash and smoke of certain kinds up into the upper atmosphere and darken the skies to the extent that it becomes winter over the continents, the interiors of the continents, and temperatures drop to 55 to 100 degrees below zero. Sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. We're not told how that happened, but one of those kind of techniques will fall. The stars will fall from the sky. I think we understood in terms of the fact that in most ancient languages, and even in English up until a century or two ago, the term star was used for meteors as well as for what we would call stars today, as well also for the planets, and the sun and moon even were considered wandering stars in antiquity. So that's a terminological change, and so this may suggest a substantial meteor fall of some sort. And the heavenly bodies will be shaken. I'm not sure how to unpack, but that may be a summary of the remarks made before. Revelation chapter 8 speaks of a series of judgments, the first four of the seven trumpets in the book of Revelation, that sound very much like a massive meteor strike, such as described in the two recent films, Deep Impact and Armageddon. We need to realize that God holds our destiny and that of all living things in His hand. Peter gives us this advice in 2 Peter 3:11 and 12. Since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought you to be? You ought to live holy and godly lives as you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming. That day will bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire, and the elements will melt in the heat. Well, that's the end of our talk here. I'm going to suggest something like this coming at the end. Don't let it catch you by surprise. Think about what life is about. Think about the evidence that we have in our universe that there is a God. Think about the evidence that's been provided in Scripture, in the history of Israel and the Church, that it's the God of the Bible. Don't let the end catch you by surprise.